Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History Number 2, Selma Berkman and Estelle Krumen are interviewing Joseph M. Katz on July 16, 1979, Side 3.
Please tell us your name and address.
Joseph M. Katz, Gateway Towers, Pittsburgh.
Now we were talking about your business.
During the war years, I expanded my stationery business to a point where I had a rather wide line sold to all of our customers. But it was during the war period that I realized that we were getting this business simply because we're a war baby and there were shortages. And when the war ended, I felt the department stores were our principal customers, like Macy's and Altman's and Marshall Field and so forth, would go back to their pre-war suppliers. So I researched everything in the creative paper field and decided to go into a business which was different than anything we'd seen. It was a relatively small industry known as gift wrappings. I could have gone into it both financially and actually then, but there was a war production board order that prevented anyone from going into a new business that consumed paper unless you were in it in 1939.
What year was this?
Well, I'm now in 1945. So after VJ Day in August of 1945, I decided we're ready to embark. In the meantime, we prepared designs and we're all set waiting for the legal requirement. But when the order was abandoned in Washington, then we went into it. In the natal day of Papercraft Corporation, it was then called September 25, 1945.
Was paper hard to get during the war? Anything, I mean, the supplies of making paper?
It was very difficult
right,
to get it.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I got it. When I was a wholesale paper merchant, so to speak, preceding that, I made great friends with paper mills, never chiseled them on price. And when the war started and they were giving allocations, I got excellent allocations.
So in September of 45, right after the war, you started Kraft Corporation with the idea of going into
wrapping.
And you would manufacture your own then?
Yes. The following year, we bought the building on Center Avenue that is, where we remained for many, many years until 12 years ago. It's now a distribution center of ours. We have 25 of them or 30 of them. That's one. It's the only one we have in Pittsburgh. And the business continued to prosper. We were innovators. The gift wrap business, as it's known today, was my brainchild. It's an entirely different field today. It's a big business today.
Before this, I don't recall, what was that kind of a business like?
Small. Very
when
small.
When people gave a gift, they just gave a gift in a box, a bag?
Well, they used colored tissue papers or they bought paper that cost two for a dime. I innovated putting paper on rolls, then putting rolls in a box with the theory that the housewife, unsure of her ability to choose and inartistic perhaps, had confidence that the manufacturer had creative people, happened to be me, who selected these designs. And therefore, they had a good selection. And from then on, our company went like this. And as we prospered, and I was looking into the cloudy crystal ball of the future, I wondered where would we get our capital. Further, with restrictive personal taxation, you couldn't pay yourself more than an X amount of money if you wanted to be honest about it. And I decided the only way we could really move forward was to become a public company. At that time, I was very active in an organization my son is active in today called the Young Presidents Organization, and your nephew Marshall is active in it. And I was a national leader in that organization, joined it in 52, very, very active in it, and the big hot issue for years was going public. I recall one day attending a seminar down at Greenbrier. on going public. And while I was listening, I made up my mind, I am going public. So that night, going to New York by train, I had Milt Shapp, who was our governor until recently, he was with me, and Chester Bland, an old friend who lives in France now, on the train. Milt had already started a company called Gerald Electronics Public, and the other fellow was one of the early conglomerateurs. And I said, fellas, I'm going to show you my balance sheet and operating statement. Like most private companies, we're pathologically secretive about it. Only the IRS, my accountant, my lawyer, and my family know it. And here it is. And their eyes pop. And Milt said, if my company were like that, it would sell for $4 a share instead of maybe $2. So I went on to New York and saw a friend of mine. I reminded him of the incident at a party 2 weeks ago. He's now the chairman of Sun Chemical.
What was his name?
Norman Alexander. And I said, Norm, how do I go public? He said, well, I have two great friends, Lehman Brothers and Eastman Dillon. I said, which one do you know the best? He said, Eastman Dillon. I said, call them. I want to meet them. Made a date for me, went over and met these bankers who were one of the titans of Wall Street. And incidentally, years later, after I'd gone public, they said, A, we were the only Jew they ever had up until that time that they sponsored, and B, the smallest company they ever sponsored.
Was Norman Alexander the head of Sun?
Sun Chemical Company.
Was he not Jewish, nor?
Yes, his real name was Eisenstadt. I remember when I asked Margie one day when they changed their name, I said, what's it like? She said, it ain't easy. We've all forgotten it used to be Eisenstadt. I think his older brother, changed his name prior to that. And he's very Jewish.
Then you became public.
In December of 1958, we've been public 20 years. And like some of my personality, we were over the counter, as all public companies are at the beginning. They usually graduate to high school, what's called at the American Stock Exchange. I said, I never want to be on the American. I want to go to New York. They said, you can't. I said, I'll wait. And I did. In January 1963, we became listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Gee, I can't believe it. It's 16 years now. Then we started acquiring companies on a very limited selective basis.
Will you mention some of those?
Yes, I would say the first acquisition was LePage's, which I bought from Johnson & Johnson. The company celebrated its 100th anniversary 2 years ago. Strangely enough, J&J, which then did $500 million, they're probably $2 billion now, couldn't make a go of this company. They bought 4 years before. They lost $8 million in 1 year. I turned it into the block in 60 days. They were too big. It was ripe for a small entrepreneurial type of company to acquire it. Then the next company we bought was a plastic manufacturing company that we run in New Jersey, American Universal, Inc., American Universal
Incorporated.
And what do they make? Plastic?
Plastic tablecloths. See, that was in 66. The next company we bought was a company I courted for 9 years. That was CPS Industries, based in Chicago, with a very big plant down in Nashville, Tennessee. We acquired them in December of 67.
And what do they do?
They were in the gift wrap business.
Gift what?
Gift wrap, just as we are, but different than we, where we sold the masses. They sold the carriage trade, mostly department stores and gift shops and that. They were an old established company. They were 52 years old at the time we got them. And they were losing money. We, in the first year of operation under our staff's guidance, they made twice as much money as they made in their 52-year history in any one year. They were suffering from the malaise of a, which is not unusual, of a second generation. First generation, I gathered, was dynamic. I never knew them. Second generation were too interested in the world of art and social sciences, spent more time on the UJA than on their business.
This was also a Jewish firm?
Yes, Weiner, for the principals.
How do you spell the name?
W-E-I-N-E-R.
My maiden name was Weiner, W-I-E-N-E-R.
W-E-I?
W-I-E-N-E-R was my name. We pronounce it Weiner and you pronounce this Weiner.
Depends how you pronounce it.
The German pronunciation is E-I is I and I-E is E.
I forget which way they spell it.
But it was Weiner.
All right, then. Are there any other companies that you've
appointed? Yes. Oh, we had a lot of trouble with that company. The United States government decided that we were forming a trust.
With this...
By acquiring another gift wrap company and this stupid lawyer down there who said, gift wrap is gift wrap. I said, no, our company makes something like the Chevrolet automobile, the masses. They make a Cadillac.
Is it finer paper, finer wrapping
paper? Yes, the designs and everything. Our customer is Mrs. Blue Collar America. Their customer was Mrs. White Collar America. Well, this kid down there, you know, they've got lawyers there who can't make a living anywhere else, who said, oh, I can't tell the difference. I think you're violating Section 7 of the Clayton Act of 1906, and therefore we want you to sell the company. Well, we thought, morally, we were so right and they were so wrong and they were so ignorant. You know, it's a shame to pay your taxes on April 15th when you have dopes like that working for you. And we fought them for years. Marshall, my son, was in charge of a great deal of the battle. And finally, the government said to us, if you don't sell it by a certain date, you're going to have to spin off. Bless you. Spin off their shares as a dividend to your shareholders. However, if you do that, if you own 1% or more, our family owns an awful lot more than 1%, you have to sell that within 6 months. Well, there'd be no market. It was silly. We'd just give up, we'd donate it to the public. So at the last minute, we sold it for about $12 million. I mean, it was ridiculous. Our asking price was $37.5 million.
What did you sell? The CPS?
CPS. We were forced to divest it.
In what year?
In the end of 74.
So you don't own that one anymore?
Unhappily.
While you're doing all this building of your business, you are also active in organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready to get to that?
Yes, I think we should. Because we are interested in that also.
Jewish and Christian, we're interested in all that you did, your community involvement.
Well, I recall when Agnes and I were interviewed by Town and Country. Remember, they had their Pittsburgh edition, they had our pictures like a lot of other people. And their interviewer, an awfully sweet girl named Pat Linden, I remember it only because she wrote me the other day, said she's doing a survey now, and she needs women to fill out this, and she sent us about 50 or 100 of these, had my secretary immediately distributed. She was so marvelous that she wanted to know how many organizations I'm involved in. I never knew. So I took out the then-current issue of Who's Who and looked at them, and I didn't realize it. I counted. I was on the boards of 23 different organizations.
You still are?
I suppose so. I'm really on letterheads mostly because...
I don't have time.
The most of my time on the outside are really spent in two organizations, Boy Scouts of America and University of Pittsburgh. There I'm on their executive committee as well as their board of trustees.
Which one, the Boy Scouts or the Pitt?
Pitt. Yeah. At Pitt I'm also...
University, you're on the board and what else?
And on the executive committee of the board. I'm also chairman of the Board of Visitors of the School of the Faculty, rather, of Arts and Sciences. See, one of my members just died. What a pity. Teddy Hazlett. What a shock. I'm also a member not the chairman, Bob Kirby, Westinghouse, the chairman, of the graduate business school at Pitt. I'm on the advisory committee of Sister Jane Scully School and Duquesne University, and finally succumbed to join another one at the University of Miami. I delivered a talk on mergers and acquisitions 2 weeks ago there.
And you're on the advisory committee there, or just giving talks there?
Where?
At University of Miami.
Oh, just, I talk at universities, so, on that subject and other business subjects. Usually my subjects are inspirational to let these kids know there's great opportunity despite high taxes and everything else. I've been able to prove that some of the most generous people to charity in America, Jews particularly, were poor during the 30s.
Right. But it's perseverance and hard work.
Sure, I have one friend who's worth $800 million. He didn't even have enough money for tuition in the 30s. Now, the country's replete with that. Well, I mean loads of other things. Scouting, I've been on the board there for many years. I'm one of their numerous vice presidents.
Is that of the national or local board?
Local.
Yes, local bike.
We're starting a camp here. It's going to be sensational when it's finished. It's called Heritage Reservation, part of scouting. We had a quiet fundraising drive here for $4.5 million. We've already raised $5 million.
Okay. And what is the camp to be called? Heritage?
Heritage Reservation. It's near Uniontown. It'll be one of the largest camps in the country, hundreds of acres. We're building a lake right now. It's unbelievable how they build it. Talk to Bruce. You know Bruce Thomas of the U.S. Steel? Bruce called me the other day. He was down there. They're damming up a valley. In 8 months of normal snow and rainfall, they'll have a lake about a mile long with a depth of over 60 feet. Can't believe how much. We had rain like yesterday.
Yes.
It would take a month.
Now, in the Jewish organizations, I know you're on some boards there, too.
Yes. I've been on the board, but not an active attendee of our local federation. Let's see, when was I chairman of the campaign? In 60 and 61. So I've been on that board, say, for 18 years.
You were the chairman of what?
The annual campaign for 2 years, 60 and 61.
You're not now as active, right?
I'm on the board, and I've always been an advisor for the board or other Montefiore Hospital.
All right.
Let me see.
You want me to turn this off?
Let me just get down to the point here. Well, some of the things I've been interested in, I've been active in the state when the governor was an old friend of mine.
You mean Shep, when Shep?
Former governor. I've been on the the Estate Planning Board.
Don't go too fast.
I've been on the National Cabinet of the United Jewish Appeal. I am presently a governor of the American Jewish Committee nationally. I'm also on a number of their committees nationally. Let me move along here.
The estate planning was for what?
State Planning Board.
Of what?
Of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I'm a trustee of the National Foundation of Ileitis and Colitis. Well, I suppose a number of others.
That gives us an idea. That's right. But now also we were going to ask you how you contrast the way you raised your children. Yeah. You started that and then did
the way you were raised or the times. How different would that involve?
I would say I was raised with a lot of all our children with great love and care. I never remember my parents ever having an argument. And there was not great privacy in our house when you've got eight people.
Yes.
But I don't think parents are like that anymore. I mean, we're living in a different world. Fortunately, our kids, Andrea and Marshall, bypass the problem a lot of youngsters had here with the problems we read about and hear about. And I would say Aggie and I were strict disciplinarians with these kids. For example, I was telling Jeanette and Harvey yesterday, the marshal went to Kiske prep school. After about a year, one weekend that he was home, I said, Marshal, how are the movies there? Don't you go to movies there? He said, well, the kids always go Friday night. I said, well, you go every Friday? He said, no, I've never been to one. I said, you? We always went to movies together. He said, well, the movie cost $1.75, and I suddenly realized his allowance was $1.50. Never complained. I remember one thing Marshall wrote me for a graduation present. He and his roommates, parents pitched in, paid their way to Europe on a trip. Marshall by then was an old hand in Europe because we'd been going there for over 100 trips since 49, and he'd gone over many times. But I'd never been to Israel. And he wrote me in 61 when he was graduated. And he said, he made a comment in there I never realized until then. He said, you know, we're not very Jewish at home. I think you and Mother ought to come over here and see this pioneer country that I visited. They've taken a boat from Naples over there on their whole tour of the continent. These kids had a very limited budget, believe me. And they slept in their bus. They had a minibus and traveled all through Europe. In fact, one night they went to a body house that charged only 50 cents a night. That's where they slept. Uh-huh. Some of the French artists of the 20th century lived in those places.
Are you ready to ask about his art collection?
Yes, we want to know about
how that started.
How you were interested in art. You said you were as a young boy.
Yes, I never
and
stopped.
How you started your collection and all that.
All right, where does one begin? I think in the world of art, you almost have to be born into it. You have to start very early. If you're an artist, you had to start drawing when you were a child. I don't know in the history of art there's anyone who started as an adult. I always acted as an artist. In fact, I even painted signs slightly apart, but still somewhat artistic as a youngster, commercially, while I was going to grade school. When I could really afford to start buying art was probably a little over 30 years ago. I recall when I lived at 5901 Stanton, my next door neighbor was Gus Bastheim, who was the owner of Wilkins Jewelry. Remember that place?
Mm-hmm.
He was an old Dutchman.
Gus Bastheim.
Bastheim. And he was a generation older than I was, and yet we had a camaraderie talking across the porch from one another. And after he died, Florence's widow said to me, said, you know, you always admired that painting over our mantel. I'm selling everything. If you'd like to have it, you can have it. She named the price, and I'll be delighted to own it. Poor Gus, during the war, he brought his relatives over from Germany. And to quote him, he said, those bastards never appreciated anything. No one ever thanked me, but one gave me this painting from his collection. So it was my first decent painting. I don't remember the subject. I don't own it anymore. And Aggie and I started going to Europe in 49. Very few Pittsburghers by then had been going unless they went pre-war. In fact, I spent like 5 years writing itineraries on for friends. At any rate, we spent a great deal of our time visiting museums. I'd drag her along. She became very interested. And we started collecting. And Paris was really the place to collect. New York didn't become an art center until many years later. In fact, I lost the bet on which was the leading art center, and it was confirmed that New York was. I had an interview the editors of Art News and Art World and also about a dozen art dealers from London, Paris, and New York. And I lost. New York is number one today, too.
Today.
At any rate, I started collecting. And I must say, I have a pretty good eye for it. In my opinion, if you don't know whether you like something or not in a millisecond, you're finished. Nothing will help you after that. Same as you women. You look at a dress immediately. You like it or reject it. art as a sculpture, you may need 5 minutes because you've got five sides with a head to look at, top of the head. And I started collecting the school at Paris. And would deal only at a cardinal rule, which I'd never broke but once. And that is, I must only acquire art from the most reputable dealers in the world.
Why did you decide on that?
Because they could prove provenance if I bought anything good. If it turned out that it was a fake or anything like that, I'd be able to come back and see them. And I remember one year...
I just thought maybe you had an unhappy experience.
I never have. Agnes called me one day, and she'd been reading that book called Fake. Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And I had gotten the copy as a gift to her. She hadn't known I had it here. She was in New York. And she said she got up in the middle of the night after reading that skinny book. She walked all around our salon, in our dining room, everywhere. Said, you know, I'm beginning to worry about these. Are you sure these are good? I said, I thought of the same thing. Yeah. But we have no Matisse.
Yes.
His specialty was Matisse. I know the dealers he really rooked. You know, he even faked, if you'll recall, he faked the bills.
Mm-hmm.
And the authentications. He had those faked. Mm-hmm.
So,
at any rate, art was in one direction at that time. About 1959, I decided to change our collection in another direction. I gave away a lot of the art. I gave a raft of it to Marshall School, and much of it is still up there. Is an Albrecht Kipe at, forget the name of the museum, they changed their name, but that was at Cornell.
Why did you decide to change the type of paintings? Is that what it was?
I can't tell you the reason.
Well, what did you collect the first?
What was it originally?
Well, I had English. I had some of the English school. I had a great Romney up there, which I bought for nothing at a Park Burnett auction. Back then, I called the Pittsburgh room, Dick Duddle. I said, anytime you want to. Told him I paid $750 at auction. I'd written down about 3,000. And there were only two bidders. There must have been 500 people in that room. I opened the bid at $500. There was one lone voice by $50 increments. So when I called Mr. Nuttall, whom I never met, even
afterwards. What was his name?
Richard Nuttall, N-U-T-T-A-L-L. He was an investment banker with Moore Leonard Lynch. And I said, I couldn't get over how low the prices are. Why didn't you buy them back? The guy really was an old-timer. He said, I felt it would be unfair for me to buy anything back. My children weren't interested. And he said he didn't even attend. It was a two-night auction. It was the only thing I wanted. I never attended the second night.
Do you still have that one, or you gave
that
away?
No, I gave that to Fairleigh Dickinson College. He asked me if I had the receipt. I said, yes, I have it. It's in glass. He said, that's worth $5,000 alone. Peter Romney, the brother of George Romney, the artist, who did this painting in 1764 when he was 30 years old, gave a receipt to the sitter, a male. Had this been a female, the thing would have been worth $100,000 then. Because Mr. Mellon bought Emma Hamilton for $430,000 during the Depression. Male pictures of all the four portrait painters of England, Gainsborough, Romney, Reynolds, and our friend I just talked about, were worthless, but females were very valuable.
Ah.
That was before the era of photography. This
mm-hmm.
is how they took them.
Mm-hmm. So you bought, and then you changed to more contemporary taste?
More contemporary, more of the active 20th century painters, and I divided them into two classes. One, the unknown painters, and second, the autograph painters. Now, one gets fooled very easily by buying an autograph, because if you buy a Picasso, good or bad, it's Picasso. Renoir, it's a Renoir. And I couldn't afford to buy only one group alone. And I thought aesthetically it wouldn't be right to do that, because you're not taking a chance. It takes courage to acquire art from unknown painters. So I would say that for a long time, I was one-third known painters, two-thirds unknown. Then it switched to two-thirds known and one-third unknown. It's like finding a stock, like an IBM or a Polaroid when no one heard of it.
It's a gamble.
Yeah, it's a big gamble. Very few of them make the grade, you know. And your local painters never make the grade. Has there ever been a Pittsburgh painter ever made it?
Mm.
Never.
John Kane.
You're right. You're right, absolutely. The house painter. Correct. He and Grandma Moses were probably the two best primitives in the country. Geez, I never thought of that. He's the only one.
I've seen some of Sam Rosenberg's paintings elsewhere.
But he's not known.
No, but I've seen it elsewhere.
Great painter.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely great. it's a shame he didn't have... See, a painter needs sponsorship.
Mm-hmm.
But Picasso... If Picasso didn't have Daniel Kahnweiler, he may never... never heard of him. May not have even lived to be 92. But you need a sponsor. And Sam didn't have any. There are no local galleries. You really have to be in New York or Paris or London. At any rate, I would say that the peak of our collecting occurred during the 60s. And the availability of more personal money had an awful lot to do with it. When I had a private company, couldn't borrow anything from the company under IRS rules that would be taxed as a dividend. But in a public company, I kept getting dividends. And I had much more wherewithal than before.
Now, is most of it in your apartments
yes.
at this point? Or here?
First, no, nothing here.
Well, there's no-